Hello, everybody, and welcome to another beautiful Thursday morning. You're listening to Bhavani at IE Green on the Progressive Radio Network. And I'm so excited today to have an old friend joining us, Sally Edwards. She is the Senior Research Associate at the Lowell Center for Sustainable Production. And she will be joining us, and I'll tell you more about her in just a little bit. But first, I want to talk to you about some things going on in the news, some ways you can take action, and of course, share my weekly recipe with you. So first, as you all know, we had an election this week, and as far as the Democrats go, it did not do so well. The New Jersey governor just squeaked out a win, but in so many of the races, we did not do well, and I think it's really, window into what is going to happen in the midterm elections. And somehow the Democrats have got to get it together to come together as a unit so we're not so divided and really put our goals on the table and let people know where we stand, because right now it's so divided and the Republicans are, if they take a majority, we're screwed. That's all I can say. It's really not a very good situation. And so for those of you that voted, thank you. For those that you didn't, please remember to do that next year. And we need everybody to really take this seriously. I mean, right now, President Biden is in Glasgow for the United Nations Climate Summit, which is called the Conference of Parties, COP26. This is the 26th year of the climate summits. And as all of you know, our past president did not take climate change seriously. And we actually went backwards in our goals towards addressing climate change. And President Biden has a lot of work to catch up on. And there are senators in Congress, even Democratic senators, that are really holding up the ability for us to move forward. We have the Build Back Better Act that, was set to really be a landmark climate change piece of legislation, and it was really watered down quite a bit. It's still better than nothing, but, President Biden's sitting at the table and wants to show the world that we're taking this seriously, and he doesn't have much to back that up. I just heard this morning on the news, that all these nations agreed to not build any more coal plants and and really withdraw from coal. And he did not join in that agreement. So we have a lot of work to do. I know as individuals, sometimes we feel powerless and there's not much we can do. But we can get involved in local government. We can get involved in nonprofit organizations that that are doing the work on the ground. And we all need to do our part, because individually, it feels like we can't do much. But if we come together and work with other people, we really can make a difference. So I have on my website today, a great article about the climate summit. But of course, it's all over the news. So you can certainly read up on it and see where it's at today. I also wrote about the Build Back Better Act and have a petition on my on my website to let your senators know to vote yes on the Build Back Better Act. This puts $550 billion towards clean energy, including manufacturing, incentives for solar and wind, and infrastructure and tax credits for electric vehicles, and the infrastructure so that people will buy electric vehicles. I mean, I know personally, it's one thing to have an electric vehicle as your second car for around town, but if it's going to be your only car and you're going to travel with it, you need to know that you can find a charging station on your route and not have to go out of your way to find a charging station. So it's really important that we all get behind the work that the president's trying to do in passing this bill back better. Let your Congress people know and sign my petition, please. I shared on my newsletter this week also about a great article on the lawn sign. And I think my sister was the first person I saw that had this lawn sign. The minute I saw it on hers, I had to get it. And it's in this house. And these in this house lawn signs have been sprouting up all over the country. And it was really great to see it on the front page of the New York Times. When I first put my lawn sign up, it lasted not even 2 weeks before someone took it down. I was hoping someone took it down because they loved it so much that they wanted to steal it and put it up on their property. But I have no idea whether they took it down because they also didn't like it. But for me, it really, I feel like it sets the stage. Anyone pulling into my driveway kind of knows where I stand. They know I'm liberal. They know that I care about people. I care about the environment. I care about Black Lives Matter. I care about women's rights. I care about science. Really kind of just puts it all out there. And I just love it. So if you, those of you don't have a one of these lawn signs, I really encourage you to get one. They're really, really fantastic. So I want to share with you all this week's recipe. It's a vegan sag paneer. And, you know, when you go to Indian restaurants, there's sag paneer and there's palak paneer. And people think they're the same, but one is made just with spinach, so it's very mild. The other one is actually made with, also made with broccoli rabe. It's half spinach and half broccoli rabe. So it has a little bit of a more full-flavored green to it, and I like it so much better. So in this vegan sag paneer, I use some spinach and I use some broccoli rabe. But it's really a great dish, and what makes it vegan is that instead of the paneer, which is an Indian cheese, I substitute tofu. So these are the ingredients you need, and this makes 6 to 8 people. I use 1.5 blocks of organic extra firm tofu that I cut into 1-inch cubes, 1/2 inch of salt, 3 tablespoons of olive oil, 1 teaspoon turmeric, 1/2 teaspoon cayenne, 2 tablespoons of coconut oil, 1 pound of spinach. And I'm usually buying the frozen, already organic chopped spinach. And that works just fine in this recipe. If you have fresh spinach coming out of the garden, definitely go for it. 2 onions, finely diced, 1/2 inch piece of fresh ginger root, 2 teaspoons of garlic minced, 1 bunch of broccoli rabe, finely chopped, that I pulse in a food processor, so it's really chopped fine. 2 teaspoons coriander, 2 teaspoons cumin, 1 teaspoon garam masala, which is an Indian spice blend, and you can find it at most specialty stores. Whole Foods certainly carries it, and you can also order it online. 1 tablespoon of chilies, and those are just hot peppers that I buy in the market. You can also buy them jarred, or you can put in red pepper flakes if you'd like as well. 3/4 cup of coconut milk and juice of 1/2 lemon. And I combine the olive oil, the turmeric, the salt, the cumin together in a large bowl, and I make a little marinade. I'm first going to place those tofu cubes into that and let that sit for 1/2 hour. The wonderful thing about tofu, and for some people, the bad thing about tofu is that it does not have much flavor of its own. So you really need to give it its flavor. And when you marinate it before cooking it, it really takes on a lot of that flavor. So you're going to let that marinate for about 1/2 hour. While that's marinating, wok and saute the onions, the chilies, the ginger, and the garlic. While that's sauteing, have it on low because you don't want to burn the garlic or the ginger. You're going to pulse the spinach and the broccoli rabe in a food processor until it's finely chopped. Going to add the rest of the spices to the wok and let that simmer for 10 to 15 minutes. And that just really brings all the flavors together. And when you toast the spices, it really brings out the aroma of the spices. Then if it's sticking to the pan, you can add a little water to that as well. And then in a heavy skillet next to it, you're going to saute the marinated tofu. And actually, I also very often, instead of sauteing the tofu, I bake the tofu in the oven, and that works really well as well. You can turn the oven on to 400 degrees, spread the tofu out on some parchment paper, and cook that in the oven. And that can be cooking while you're sauteing the other vegetables. And that's a nice way of, you know, not dirtying another pan, using less oil, and that really works well. So then add the spinach and the broccoli rabe to the wok. Add a half a cup of water to help steam the greens, and mix that all up. Once that's all mixed up, you can add the tofu when it comes out of the oven, and the coconut milk to the spinach mixture, and mix it all up. Allow that to cook down for about 10 minutes. At the very end, right before serving it, you add the half a lemon juice. Just squeeze the lemon right on that, and that just makes the flavor pop. And it's really a really nice addition. And you're going to serve that with some saffron rice. And that is it. So I hope you all give it a try. It's wonderful. I love Indian food. It's one of my favorite ethnic groups to cook with. So do try it. And now it's my pleasure to introduce to all of you Dr. Sally Edwards. As I said before, she is a senior research associate at the Lowell Center for Sustainable Production at the University of Massachusetts Lowell. She has many years of experience in engaging a wide range of stakeholders to promote the environmental health of communities and develop safer and greener products. She conducts research to identify environmentally sound solutions and works actively with the Green Chemistry and Commerce Council to advance the use of green chemistry in product design and development. Sally's latest endeavor is the creation of a new podcast called Persistent and Pervasive: Feminists Take on Toxics, that we'll be hearing more about in just a little bit. Sally also provides consulting services to businesses, NGOs, and communities to support their environmental sustainability efforts. She serves on the board of Women's Voices for the Earth, which is an environmental organization based in Missoula, Montana, whose mission is to amplify women's voices to eliminate the toxic chemicals that harm our health and communities. Sally holds an MS in Environmental Health and Science from Harvard University and BA in Human Biology from Stanford University, and her doctorate from the University of Massachusetts. And she has a book out called Beyond Child's Play: Sustainable Product Design in the Global Doll Making Industry, which was published in 2009. And so, Sally, welcome.
Thank you. It's so nice to be here. And I just want to say that recipe sounds delicious. I plan to make it. And also, I really appreciate your reflections on what's happening in the world and how we have to all stay active and keep working to create positive change in the world. I think many of us felt discouraged after the election yesterday, but we can't give up. You know, we just have to keep working. And I so appreciate your progressive voice and your encouragement. Thank you.
Yeah. It's, you know, it's so easy to feel helpless and powerless, and we just can't allow that to happen. We have to stay active. And I talked to someone not that long ago about how she stays optimistic and engage and not lose hope. And she said by surrounding herself with others doing the same. It's actually when you become active and you surround yourself with other people that are doing good, then you feel empowered, as opposed to the other way around where you just feel overwhelmed. There's nothing I can do, and you just want to hide your head in the sand. That just does not work.
No, so. I think that's absolutely true. And I just recently read an interview with Jane Goodall. She's in her 80s. And, you know, she's someone who's written in many of her books about hope and continuing to, you know, put out that message of the change that we can create. And she's someone I really admire because she used to travel all over the world giving her talks. And now she spends 10 hours a day on Zoom giving her message all over the world. And, you know, it's if she can keep doing it, so can we.
Absolutely. So I know I had you as a guest many years ago, talking about all the amazing work you're doing with, you know, toxic chemicals in women's products predominantly. but now you've started this podcast. Can you share with us what made you decide to create a podcast on feminist environmental health?
Yeah, I'd be happy to. I've been at this for a long time, and this podcast is truly a labor of love for me, because I feel like I have learned so much from feminist scientists and activists over the years. And I really wanted to raise up their voices, because we often don't hear from the progressive voices who are working to create change. And I thought, here's an opportunity. You know, I thought about interviewing them and writing a book, but I thought I should dip my toe and learn about podcasting, and that might be a way to get this message out.
And so when did you actually start the podcast?
I started it... you know, it's something I've been thinking about for a while. And actually, right before the pandemic hit, I hired a young woman who knew a lot more about podcasting than me and had a background in environmental science to work with me. So we started shaping it up about right before the pandemic. We started thinking last January, started shaping it, and we created the first episode last fall, and then have worked on two more episodes this year. And we, you know, this is not a weekly podcast. It's much more, it's researched and curated, and it's really designed to go pretty deep into each of the topics.
And when did you actually start it? How many have you done?
We have two that are out, and we have the third one on its way.
And what were the topics of the first two?
First, just a little bit more about the title and why we call it persistent and pervasive, because, it's a bit of a double entendre in that persistent and pervasive refers both to the toxic chemicals, because many toxic chemicals are pervasive in the environment, and persistent, meaning they don't break down in the environment. But also, I've found that the scientists and activists that I've worked with are also very persistent in their work. And I'm hoping that their message and their communication becomes more pervasive. So that was the title. That's why we came up with that title. And we structured it around products marketed to girls and women, because they're the ones that are mostly exposed to the product, both because of gendered cultural norms, but also because of gendered work environment. Like, it's mostly women who are domestic workers, house cleaners. They're the ones who work in hair and nail salons, et cetera. So we picked products such as cleaning products or cosmetics or menstrual products as a way to tell this story. And, you know, going back to your comment about having hope, the way we structure the podcast is, first we talk about the problem. You know, what are the toxic chemicals in these products, and why are those toxics in there in the first place? But then the second part of the podcast is always on solutions. What are scientists and activists doing to solve the problem, and how does a feminist lens maybe change how the solution is thought about? So we decided that our first topic would be menstrual products and intimate care products. And partly we picked that because it's sort of a taboo topic to talk about, but it's one that really needs to be discussed openly, because women are putting these products into sensitive tissue in their bodies. And those products should be safe. And there's really a lack of regulatory oversight into those products. And it's just in the last three years, California passed a law and New York has passed a law that requires manufacturers to be transparent about the ingredients in menstrual products. Up until now, it's been very difficult to even know what's in those products. And they do contain chemicals that are linked to cancer, hormonal disruption, and some cause allergic reactions. And, you know, tampons are used by about 70% of menstruating people in the U.S. And some of the other products like douches, sprays and washes are used by fewer women, but more rates are much higher among women of color. So, we really felt like we wanted to have a frank conversation, understand the historical, sort of the marketing practices and the history, and then look to solutions. So that was the first podcast. And then the second one that's turned into a mini series is really looking at cleaning workers and cleaning products, particularly during the pandemic. And our first, because we had so much material, actually our first podcast is more on the problem, and the podcast we're just finishing up is more on solutions. And we really learned how cleaning workers, not surprisingly, faced really high exposures to toxic chemicals because of the increased use of toxic disinfectants during, especially in the beginning of the pandemic, because everyone was so frightened and didn't really know what needed to be done. Domestic workers also lost their jobs without having any kind of safety net, because many of them are immigrant women, many of them don't have health insurance. And we learned by speaking, we interviewed two feminist historians who really showed us the historic parallels of past pandemics and how workers were treated. For example, when there was a yellow fever outbreak at the border about 100 years ago, how workers were treated in the same way. And, back then and this time around, the assumption was that the family for whom one's work takes priority over the worker. We learned a lot about the fact that many of these attitudes and the way workers were treated, particularly cleaning workers, has a long history, and it's a history of devaluing that work. But on the hope side of it, in the podcast we're just finishing, we interviewed a Brazilian, a woman who's helped start with a group of Brazilian house cleaners, a worker-owned cleaning co-op in the Boston area. And that has allowed the workers to, one, decide what products they want to use, and they become the experts with their clients, introducing safer cleaning products. They also help each other. They put a bit of money into an account so that if one of them is sick or has to pick up their child at daycare and can't work that day, there's a way that they get, that they don't lose their wages. They help each other and they have much more control over their work. Mm-hmm. And when the pandemic hit, that account had enough money in it that those women, had a safety net in a way that they often do not. So that, that's one of the solutions we're highlighting. How do we shift this so that cleaning workers really aren't at the mercy of their employers, who may or may not be generous? I bet, many people ask the cleaning workers to stop coming. Some people continue to pay their cleaning workers, but others did not do that. We are often not thinking about the consequences to others of our actions, especially when, especially at the beginning of the pandemic, where we were getting lots of information that we were sorting through.
Mm-hmm.
So that's kind of a long answer to your question. But, we're trying to, with each of the podcasts, we're taking a consumer product, like menstrual products or cleaning products, where women and girls are disproportionately exposed, and it's not even, and then certain communities of women, because of their work, maybe even disproportionately exposed, and trying to look at that exposure, but then also look at ways to solve the problem. In the other episodes that we hope to do as we build this podcast, and partly we're working to get funding to continue it, is to look at another story we want to tell is the story of hair straighteners, because these products are primarily used by Black women, and they have endocrine disrupting chemicals and asthmogens in them. So we really want to explore the cultural issues around hair straightening. We're also going to look at skin lightening creams, which also contain toxic chemicals and are very widely used throughout the world, actually. And we'll be looking at products used in nail salons. And, you know, nail salons, about 97% of nail salon workers are women. They're primarily, the largest ethnic group is Vietnamese women. And many of these women are, you know, they're young women of reproductive age breathing in reproductive toxins as they do, you know, their clients' nails. So, you know, again, looking at the problem, looking at what the solution is, because I think mm-hmm. it's a way to tell the story through the products and through the work environment. So that's what we're trying to do. And again, because I've been in this field for so long, I've met so many thoughtful scientists and activists, and I really want their stories to be heard, because that's, you know, that's what we do on progressive radio, right? Or in progressive mm-hmm. environments, is we try to tell right. the stories of the folks that we haven't heard from.
Yeah. Well, that's great, because you're so right that these stories need to be told, because, you know, people don't think twice about it. I mean, tampons have been out and around for ages, and no one thinks twice about what is in them. And you're right. You're putting it right up your body into, you know, mucous membrane tissue that is, you know, that will just absorb everything. And, you know, I hope you do one also, although this has been covered before. It's just, you know, skin products, you know, things people yeah. put on their skin. People don't think of their skin as their largest organ and absorbs everything. And I always freak out when I see women, you know, young mothers just globbing sunscreen all over their children, and even when they're, you know, it's almost like, you know, because they make, you know, the sun might hit their skin at some point. I mean, you know, it's gotten out of hand, the amount of sunscreen that some people are putting on their kids, and it's just right. you know, I don't think it's good,
right?
You know, it's one thing if you're at the beach.
Right. No, and it's, and there are safer and more toxic sunscreens. So, you know, it's important to, you know, hopefully, especially I hope mothers of young children are getting educated about that, because you're right. Mm-hmm. We sort of overdo things without necessarily thinking about it, because it's become a habit. Mm-hmm. And it might not be safe and healthy. I mean, I'm sure you think about that a lot in thinking about healthy food.
Yeah.
It's the same. There are a lot of parallels.
Yeah. Now, I love the model that you just described, the women-owned cleaning cooperative. Is that a replicable setup? Like, is that something that other groups can learn from and repeat and copy, so that they can set these up, you know, across the country, so that they have some power?
Yeah, I mean, I think it is, and I've looked, you know, we interviewed a woman from Boston who helped found the worker-owned cleaning co-op. It's called Vida Verde. And I've seen that there's some cleaning co-ops in New York City and in San Francisco. I didn't interview folks from those. So I know there are models. And I know that during the pandemic, from our interview with Eloisa Galveo, she said that they encouraged... you know, they do a lot of trainings on safer products, and they teach cleaning workers how to make safer products, because you can make household cleaning products from regular, from household products, you know, from, and they encourage them to start their own co-ops of just a few, you know, you can start a co-op with just a few people, but as a way to, again, share the load, be able to have a little more control over your working hours, et cetera. Mm-hmm. Another thing that, you know, and this is through the work of the National Domestic Workers Alliance, which is an organization that advocates for the rights of domestic workers. They've started a platform. It's an online platform called ALEA. And it doesn't solve the health insurance problem, but what it does, the cleaning worker signs up and then invites, because many cleaning workers maybe have 10 or more clients, right? They work at a different house or a couple houses every day. So they can invite their employers to this website, and then the employer can give a minimum of $5, but even more every time the cleaning worker comes. They just it automatically goes into the cleaning worker's account. And then it sort of gives that cleaning worker money that they can use toward health insurance or paid time off or sick leave, for example, because obviously unless you're a full-time worker and you live in a state where there are benefits for cleaning workers, and there are only 10 states, I believe, for which that's true, they're not getting any of those benefits that most workers do. So, you know, that's another model. I would like to see that everyone has, you know, affordable health care, and we need to strive toward that. But that's sort of that's another model where employers can voluntarily support folks that work for them in the, you know, sort of informal network that often domestic workers are part of.
Mm-hmm. I know this is a little bit of a tangent, but, you know, I know personally, I have bought so many natural, environmentally friendly cleaning products for my cleaning lady, and she won't use them. She doesn't say, she says they don't work as well. And, you know, it's like, you know, I have not found one that is equivalent to soft scrub, for instance, you know. Did you in your research come up with alternatives to some of the products that, like, even, you know, mixing vinegar with water for, you know, instead of Windex, you know, she doesn't like it. She says it says streaks, and she wants that blue Windex, you know, and if it's not that blue Windex, she's not happy. Do you have any?
Well, this is a challenge because, and it's partly educating both the employer and the employee, because sometimes the reason that the more toxic products work is simply because they're more toxic, right? They can cut through the grease and the dirt more easily. I would say green cleaning products have really, and actually we interview a scientist, an engineer who's done a lot of research. At the University of Massachusetts, we have an institute, our sister institute is the Toxic Use Reduction Institute, and they have a cleaning laboratory where they test cleaners, and they helped. So when the women in the worker-owned cleaning co-op came up with their own recipes, the cleaning lab tested their products and found them to be safer and effective. So cleaning products, like 10 years ago, green cleaning products, I think, were not as effective and kind of got a bad rap. They're much more effective now. So one, the woman who cleans, you might try some of the newer products Well, I'll come back to like how you identify those in a minute. But the challenge with some green cleaning products is, yes, they don't contain those toxic chemicals, but you might have to work a little harder. You might have to scrub a little harder. Now that, you know, that's maybe not an issue for a casual cleaning, but for someone who's working 10 hours or 8 hours a day cleaning houses, it's understandably a concern because it might be harder on a person's body. To have to work harder to get something clean. Right. But at the same time, you would hope, you know, as you, if the worker has an understanding of the exposure that they're getting through breathing, that breathing in the air that has that chemical in it, you know, they may really be more open to switching. But you do, you know, one of the things we talk about a lot in my work is that it has to be safer, it has to be effective, and it has to be affordable. Like it can't just be safer. If it doesn't work very well, or if it's too expensive, it's not going to be adopted. You know, right. And that's really relevant to, you know, to workers, to cleaning workers. And that's why, you know, I love this concept of the worker-owned cleaning co-op, because those women have come up with the products that they want to use that they feel are safer and effective, and they educate their clients, and their clients are very bought into it because it's often clients like you that don't want to have toxic chemicals in their home. Mm-hmm. You know, the woman that comes to clean our home just told me she was pregnant. And I have really worked to transition to all safer products, but I took another look again, because I really, you know, and I'm only one of the places where she cleans homes, but I said to her, are you really, you know, you've got to be so careful about right. what you're being, you know, and she, you know, a lot of women don't have the freedom to question what products are being handed to them. And some of these products are so well marketed. Here's a sidebar story, but the state of California passed a law a few years ago, and it was a right to know law, where manufacturers had to reveal what was in cleaning products. And again, this is a new thing. There are only a few states. New York and California are the two states that require this. And the California law has, you know, it's now a few years in effect. And manufacturers had to also share what's in fragrance, the fragrances of the products. And that, you know, fragrances, that the ingredients in fragrances are highly, highly guarded as, you know, intellectual property they don't want shared. So Fabuloso, which is a brand that's heavily marketed to the Latinx community, it's highly fragranced. Women's Voices for the Earth did research on what had been revealed through this law, and they found that some of the fragrances in Fabuloso contained a reproductive toxin. You know, and again, it's often young women of reproductive age using these products and inhaling the fumes from these products. So, you know, I hope Fabuloso, I hope the makers have taken that, have read that report and taken that fragrance out. But the flip side is, if you're a cleaner and you're used to using that product and it works and your clients like it, it's very hard to change, right? That's human nature. That it's very, very hard to change. So, you know, my advice to you is just to keep, you know, there's some good, the EPA has a Safer Choice label. There's also Eco Logo, Green Seal, and Cradle to Cradle. Those are four reputable eco labels for cleaning products. So you know that they do use safer ingredients. And try out some products that have those reputable labels with your employee to find something that she or he, but usually she, sees as effective and that you can feel is safer for her and for your family.
Right. Right. Well, I'll get some of those links from you and share them on my website so that everybody listening here can have access as to where to go, because I think this is such important information that everyone needs to know, and it's not easy to find out. And as we know, and we've seen this with the pharmaceutical companies and food production companies, for them, it's all about the bottom line and profit. And they're not, you know, they don't care about us. They don't care about what toxins are in something. They just want to know how much money they're going to make from it. And, you know, and they want to make as much as they can. And so, you know, battle, you know, it's just another area to fight in, and it's so important, you know, and I think it's an area we don't think about very much. You use the term intersectional often, you know, in feminism. What does that mean?
Well, it's a term, intersectional, it was coined by the scholar Kimberly Crenshaw in 1989, and it's a concept that, when it comes to thinking about inequalities and the persistence of inequalities, categories like gender, race, and class, you really need to understand them as overlapping rather than isolated or distinct. So you need to understand the cumulative way in which effects of forms of discrimination such as racism, sexism, and classism combine and overlap. So intersectional feminism really takes into account these complexities and overlaps. So if you're a Black woman, you're dealing with racism and with sexism, for example. And if you're a low income, you're also dealing with issues of class. So you can't look at these issues in isolation. You really need to understand them in an intersectional way. And some people, you know, I think intersectionality, it's, you know, it's much more widely used now as a way to sort of encompass that complexity.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think, you know, I know I've always talked about connecting the dots and how so many of these issues, they are, you can't separate them. They are. And I think, you know, with Black Lives Matter and the whole movement that, you know, became so much more prevalent during COVID, and, you know, and we saw the inequality of, you know, even the pandemic and how it hit different socioeconomic groups. And, you know, I think more and more people are starting to grapple with these ideas of the intersectionality of issues and things, and making those connections a little bit more.
I think, you know, in the climate justice movement, there's been an increased awareness around the intersectionality of all of these issues too, that we can't approach climate change as a, you know, the way often progressive environmentalists have. You know, we have to be much more intersectional and looking at how climate change is impacting communities of color differently than more affluent white communities. You know, so again, we have to look at it. And on the one hand, it's impacting all of us. On the other hand, if you live in a fence line community, if you live next to polluting factories, for example, you're being impacted in a different way than if you live, you know, in a suburban community away from where manufacturing happens. So, you know, it's part of really, you know, understanding environmental justice and climate justice. It's thinking of solutions that take all of that in mind.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Do you get into looking at the marketing of these products too? I guess I'm thinking, you know, about your first podcast, which is, you know, dealing with menstrual products and how things are marketed, especially to young women. You know, I know with food, you know, there's this horrible reality of how they market to children, you know, so that children really, you know, love certain products. And, you know, we've seen it with e-cigarettes, you know, how they're marketing and they target these certain groups. Have you seen marketing being targeted towards certain groups when it comes to, you know, the feminist products that you were covering?
Well, yes. you know, we haven't, that's definitely an aspect of what we talk about in the podcast. And I think that, you know, young women are marketed to in terms of fragranced products and, you know, the sort of intimate care, quote unquote, feminine hygiene products that are marketed to young women that often aren't even, they're not really, you don't really need to use vaginal wipes and the kinds of things that are marketed to young women, but it's all about, you know, sort of the beauty culture, right? The young beauty culture. So, you know, we try to you know, really have a critical eye to how these are being marketed to women. And I'm glad that, you know, some young women are really pushing back and they're developing their own safer products companies. The menstrual cup, the silicone menstrual cup is a, you know, I certainly in the women in their 20s that I've talked to about this, many of them are choosing that as an alternative, partly from an environmental perspective. They don't want to be using thousands of tampons over their lifetime, but partly because they see it as a safer alternative. But there's, yeah, as you say, Bhavani, there's heavy marketing. And, you know, depending on whether you're getting, you're just sort of getting marketing from the mainstream media versus knowing about how to look for alternatives, they're certainly not telling young women that they're chemicals of concern in the products that they're being marketed to.
Yeah. And like you said earlier, affordability is really an issue too. I mean, a lot of those products that are alternatives are really expensive. Like I've seen the underwear, you know, that has like a built-in sponge in it, you know, great idea. But they're like $25, $30 a pair, something like that, you know, which makes them unaffordable.
And unaffordable and also maybe unavailable in your local store, depending on where you live.
So what are the most effective strategies for ensuring that the products we purchase and use are safe and healthy for people and the planet? You know, where do you go to? And that's one of the things I was saying, you know, I'd love you to share with me and I'll share with others.
But where do
people go?
Yeah, well, I mean, I guess the first thing I want to say is we can't shop our way out of the problem, partly because for one thing, as Bhavani just said, you might not be able to afford these products, but toxic chemicals are underregulated. So that even though we would like to think we can walk into a store and any product on the shelf has been regulated and is safe, that's not true. So we have to start by being activists. And if you learn about products that aren't safe, to call those companies and demand that they use safer chemicals in those products. And also we have to work, you know, I think what I've learned over my years of working in environmental health is the two strongest drivers for safer products are one, strong regulation, and that has to be at the federal and state level. And second, the activism of NGOs, you know, because environmental nonprofit organizations, they coalesce our individual citizen voices, and they can really push on retailers and manufacturers to stop selling products that aren't safe. So you really need both. So you need to be an activist. You need to, and we need people who are good at policy advocacy, who can go to state legislatures and go to the federal government and push for change. There's certainly, you know, as I mentioned, there's some reputable eco labels. So there, you know, there are safer products available, but not in every category. And, you know, and for example, you know, one of the, you know, categories of chemicals that we're learning is very back to the title, persistent and pervasive, are the perfluorinated chemicals, which you may have heard of as PFAS, P-F-A-S. That's a whole class of several thousand chemicals, which have been very widely used for water repellency and stain resistance. So these are the chemicals that are on your raincoat when they're in food packaging, they're on tents, they're on outdoor furniture. They're very, very widely used and very much underregulated. And they are now found in thousands of drinking water systems across the country. My town has found elevated levels of perfluorinated chemicals. And if you look up your town, you may find that's true for your community as well. And EPA has a drinking water advisory, but does not have a standard for these chemicals. And EPA is just beginning to start, obviously was not, this issue was not really paid attention to in the last administration, and the Biden administration is beginning to take this seriously. So hopefully we'll see a standard, but it's an example of a chemical class that's so widespread because it's used in so many applications. And of course it's used because it functions well. It does repel water and stains, but it mm-hmm. unfortunately has unintended consequences of hormonal disruption and other health effects. So, back to the message of you can't really shop your way out of this. You can partially, but we have a larger problem with unsafe chemicals in many of our consumer products, and we really need to raise our voices around Absolutely. Chemical safety.
Yeah, and that's another area where people can become active. I know I've interviewed people from the Right to Know, and that's a great organization. And I didn't realize, I thought it was a national, but you're saying Right only active in like California and New York, and what other states? Were you saying, Sally?
Oh, that was just, that was just particularly a law passed on cleaning products. The Right to Know the Ingredients. The organization I'm on the board of, Women's Voices for the Earth, is a really great place for people to get involved. We actually have a celebration and fundraiser this evening at 7:30 Eastern Time. If anyone's interested in tuning in, it's an hour long, sort of reflection on the work of Weave and what we're doing going forward. But it's a great way to learn about the organization. It's womensvoicesfortheearth.org. It's not too late to sign up. And there are other environmental NGOs as well. But, if you're particularly interested in the, focus I've been talking about, which is products marketed to women and girls and really trying to advocate to get toxic chemicals out of those products, you might be really interested in this event this evening.
Thank you. I will certainly join. That's great. I recommend very often the Environmental Working Group. They have some great lists about, safer products. Also cornucopia.org, certainly, when it comes to food products. But one of the things I've seen with food products, and tell me if it's the same with cleaning products, because I'm not sure, is that when these environmentally good companies or person starts a company to do good, and all of a sudden starts competing with the more traditional products, those smaller companies end up getting bought out by the bigger companies. And then all of a sudden the good product starts not becoming so good anymore. I've certainly seen that with, going way back with soy milk, when Silk first came out, it was all organic, right? And then I don't know if it was Nestle or I don't remember which company bought it up. But once it was bought up, all of a sudden it was no longer automatically organic. They had a regular brand and then a special organic one. But all these people that were already loyal consumers, kept buying it, not knowing that it had been changed. And I've seen that many times. I mean, I just found out that my Echinacea Golden Seal tincture that I've been using for 30 something years no longer has Golden Seal in it. And I was like, jeez. It was my natural antibiotic per se, It's like I depended on this tincture and it no longer has Golden Seal in it. And it's like, I have no idea how long it's been since they took that out. I stopped looking at the ingredient list because I've been a loyal customer. And that happens so often where you stop looking at the ingredients because you think you already know the product and it's been changed. It's been bought out by someone else and it's no longer the small, nice little hippie that started it. It's now a corporate or a subsidy of some big mega corporation and it no longer has the values that it started with. Do you see that in cleaning products?
Yeah, I mean, it's really tricky because Yes, that does happen, and it all depends on the agreement that's made between the smaller company and the larger company. I mean, an alternative story, Seventh Generation, which is, you know, certainly a company that was designed to, and, you know, its whole mission is to make healthy, safe products, was purchased by Unilever, which is a huge, you know, a huge company. But I work closely with the chemist at Seventh Generation, and they, I think they continue to be true to their mission. And they're also very, you know, they publicly advocate in Washington for safer chemicals and safer products. And I think they've been given the freedom to do that. So, you know, the good part about getting acquired by a larger company is you can, you get a bigger market for your products. But you're right. In some cases, it means your product gets watered down or isn't what it used to be. So, you know, it's sort of a reminder that as consumers / customers, we really have to be vigilant. And that's why we can't be passive. And right. It's sort of not fair because a lot of us are, you know, we're so busy. A lot of people don't have time to do that kind of research. And you want to, you should be able to walk into a store and know that whatever product you're going to pick up is going to be safe for yourself and your family. And we don't, it's, unfortunately, it's not true.
Right.
And so, but, and that's why we need to support groups like Women's Voices, the Environmental Working Group, and other organizations that are kind of trying to do that research for us and synthesize it to help us make those decisions.
Right. Because, you know, so much of the research that the EPA depends on is the research being done by the corporation putting out the products,
right.
You know, and that's, you know, always something that I have found super troubling because, and they do that, you know, with the pharmaceutical companies too, you know, the research of, oh, this is a safe product always comes from the research that the companies who's in line to make the profit does.
Right.
And it's So how can you really trust that testing? You know, and that's what happens all the time. They say the EPA doesn't have money for it. The Food and Drug Administration doesn't have money for it. So they don't have money to do their own testing. So they have no choice but to trust the testing of these corporations whose mission is to make as much money for their shareholders as possible.
Yeah.
And
or
so,
to create doubt, you know, to say, you know, if because often they're academic researchers finding that a chemical does cause harm to humans or the environment, and then there are alternative researchers saying, well, not really, you know, and those are often funded by those companies to create doubt so that there is no scientific consensus on the harm that a chemical causes. I mean, I think it's a fox in the hen house kind of situation.
Right. Yeah. Sure. No. Sally, this is just so great. So we are just about out of time, but I am really looking forward to tonight. I'm going to
I'll send you the link.
And please do. And I will share that out there. And also send me the links to the organizations that you depend on for your research for safer products. And I will share that in my newsletter and on my website with all of my followers, because it's information that is really needed and it's hard to find. So thank you.
You're welcome. This has been a pleasure. So good to talk to you.
Thank you. And everyone out there, thanks again for joining us. You've been listening to Bhavani at IE Green and my guest, Sally Edwards, and her new podcast, Persistent and Pervasive, Feminists Take on Toxins. Thank you, Sally. And thank you everyone for joining us. And I'll see you all again next week. Bye for now.